This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire approved its medical marijuana law in July 2013, but now, almost 2 years later, qualifying patients still have nowhere to legally obtain it. Earlier this month, the state did choose three nonprofit providers to open alternative treatment centers that will do so, with locations still to be determined. So the process is moving ahead, albeit slower than advocates would like. In fact, one of them has sued the state, saying it hasn't kept pace with the law's official timeline. But other states have also experienced this gap between passage of medical marijuana and practical implementation. Putting these policies in place on the ground can be complicated, full of legal and logistical challenges, in the words of one of our guests today. This hour in The Exchange, struggles over medical marijuana in New Hampshire and nationally. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests to start off our hour. With us from Colorado is Carmen Hansen, program manager for the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan organization. Carmen covers medical marijuana laws for NCSL. She's based in Denver. Carmen, great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Casey McDermott, reporter for the Concord Monitor. She's been following New Hampshire's medical marijuana rollout. And Casey, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Later on in the hour, we'll hear from a reporter in Maine looking at this issue there, and also a reporter from Connecticut and looking at the rollout of medical marijuana in that state. Carmen, just to you first, how typical is this to see a considerable amount of time between a medical marijuana law signed by the governor on the books and medical cannabis actually available on the ground?
Yes, it does take generally anywhere from 6 months to 18, even 24 months to become operational. And it really depends on the size of the program and the level of regulation and oversight that the state takes on with the entire process, such as licensing both the growers and the dispensaries and the role of local governments as well.
So how these laws are crafted, Carmen, makes a difference in terms of how slow or fast the rollout is?
Definitely. The more that a state is using kind of another state as their model, or as, at least as their base for their law, it can go more smoothly because they can learn from what the other state's road bumps were.
And you mentioned what towns decide to do on this. Are you seeing, Carmen, in a lot of states that local jurisdictions also have control as to whether they will host a dispensary or not?
Yes, in the 23 states that have programs, all but one, which is Illinois, allows for local control. So, for example, in Colorado, only 21 of the 64 counties in Colorado allow for medical dispensaries. So there are both county-level availability to not allow medical distribution as well as for localities.
So give that to us again, Carmen, because we have this impression here that, you know, it's sort of the Wild West in Colorado in terms of marijuana, you know, anybody, anywhere. But you're saying 21 of 64 counties, give us that again, because that's striking.
Yes, sure. Only one-third of the Colorado counties allow for medical dispensaries, and that's the same actual statistic for retail as well, for our adult use program. But again, you know, it is largely a Denver Metro Front Range issue and a mountain community issue. It's not generally, so to speak, in the corners of the state.
Wow. So, Casey, it shows us that it's one thing to have a law on the books. It's another thing to actually see a dispensary on your corner. What was the timeline supposed to be in New Hampshire, Casey?
So the original law, which went into effect in the summer of 2013, outlined a timeline for when certain portions of the rules related to the law were supposed to be finished. So the rules for the registry, which is written into the law as a way to keep track of the people who are given basically the authority to possess medical marijuana, that would be qualifying patients and their caregivers. The rules for that registry was supposed to be were supposed to be ready by July 2014, and the state did meet that deadline. Now, the rules for the alternative treatment centers, which are basically dispensaries, were supposed to be ready by January of 2015, and the state met that deadline. Also by January 2015, though, the law indicated that the state was supposed to have licensed or issued licenses to the at least two alternative treatment center applicants, provided that they received applications that met certain criteria. So there was kind of a caveat in there where the state had not received applications at that point, so they couldn't, you know, license as provided in the law.
And actually, something you said made me think of another question I wanted to ask you and Carmen. Patient registry. So patients have to register for this. What about providers, Casey?
So my understanding is that so if I'm a patient who wants to apply for medical marijuana under New Hampshire's law, I would have to have a relationship with a medical provider that I believe has to last at least 3 months. And then I would go to that provider. They would issue written certification, and that would be included in the application that is submitted then to the Department of Health and Human Services for review.
So I've got my card, or you've got your card, and then you don't have to keep going back for, you know, more prescriptions, quote unquote.
I believe it's on an annual basis that that would need to be a reapplication would need to be submitted.
And that's an issue in other states, right, Carmen? I mean, what providers do with this? For example, we're going to hear later from Connecticut, where providers are kind of hesitant to hand out. I don't think you can call it a prescription. I think it's a recommendation. Give us a little more on that, Carmen, please.
Yes, they're usually called referrals or recommendations. And in most states, doctors don't need to sign up to be able to participate. It's just a matter of, are they in good standing with their medical board, so they are a licensed physician or an osteopath.
So you can do this if you're a health provider, no matter what? You don't have special training or anything like that?
Not necessarily. There are some states that have what would be kind of the equivalent of a continuing education or seminars for physicians who would like to learn more about how to determine if someone, if it would be helpful for someone with the various conditions that it's allowed for in each state. But it's not mandatory as far as a certification in order to write a referral or recommendation.
Again, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking about medical marijuana laws here in New Hampshire, but around the country as well. Rollouts in some places have been difficult. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And our guests include Casey McDermott. She's a reporter for the Concord Monitor. She's been following this. And Carmen Hansen. She's program manager for the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan organization. Carmen's been tracking these laws around the country. And Casey, to you, just remind us of the particulars of New Hampshire's law. It's often said to be tightly written.
Right. So New Hampshire outlines a handful of conditions that someone would need to have in order to apply for medical marijuana permission under the law. And that would be the presence of cancer, glaucoma, HIV, AIDS, a number of other conditions. But there's also a clause in there that says that there has to be the presence of that as well as certain other conditions or symptoms. And this must be the patient needs to have tried other forms of treatment.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that, you know, would have produced side effects or other, you know, symptoms. And then they can apply for medical marijuana.
So you have to be, A, really struggling, and B, have tried other options before you go to see medical marijuana.
Yeah.
How does that compare nationally, Carmen? I'm guessing that states are all over the map in terms of that.
Yes, there are most programs do have a qualifying list of conditions and or symptoms, like Casey mentioned. The most common conditions and symptoms are for severe seizure disorders, cancer, ALS, multiple sclerosis, HIV, AIDS, Alzheimer's, glaucoma, and Parkinson's. And then, again, those most common symptoms are intractable or severe pain, nausea, muscle spasms, and seizures. Less common are things such as like Crohn's, spinal cord injuries or disease, traumatic brain injuries, even some mental conditions such as like a PTSD or depression, anorexia, and muscular dystrophy are also items that you might see in there, but they're more on the rare end in the 23 state programs.
Yeah, PTSD, that's been talked about, Casey, right, here in New Hampshire?
Yes, it has. And just reading back over some coverage from the years leading up to this, my understanding is that Governor Hassan said that she was not supportive of a bill that would have included PTSD in there. So right now, New Hampshire's law does not allow for that.
Another aspect of New Hampshire's law, Casey, that's been controversial is no home grow mm-hmm. option, only 4 licensed dispensaries. Give us a little more there.
Right. So one of the things that people that was being discussed as this law was being worked on was, you know, can we give people a way to grow their own cannabis if they either, you know, live far away from a dispensary or if they're waiting, as many patients are right now, to be able to access cannabis through the dispensary. So right now, New Hampshire's law does not have a home cultivation option. There has been an attempt to add that in through the legislative process. But
several attempts, right?
Yes, yeah, but that's not been finalized yet.
What's the concern around that?
I think the concern from some of the opponents is just, you know, it's harder to regulate. It's harder to just keep tabs that, you know, the substance would be, you know, good for people to be consuming. But, you know, the patients and other advocates are saying, you know, this is presumably going to be cheaper than what we might be able to get at these dispensaries. And also it's going to get us access to the substance faster.
Yeah. So talk about that, too, Carmen, because my read of laws around the country is that this varies a lot state by state, this home grow or not.
It does, definitely. As Casey mentioned, you know, New Hampshire does not allow for home cultivation, and 15 other states also will allow for home cultivation. So it might be limited. You can have anywhere maybe from 6 plants to, you know, I've seen as high as like 15 or even more, but that more is a little more rare. It's generally around 6 to 12 plants.
And this also gets to the point of who can grow those plants, Carmen, right? Who has the right to do that or not?
Yes, you must be, in most states, you need to be a registered caregiver. So you have to go through a process as well of getting a license to be growing on behalf of somebody else who may be unable to grow. Say it's a, you know, a senior citizen or someone who just doesn't have the availability or the ability to grow for themselves.
Is this one of the issues that some states get stuck on, Carmen?
It doesn't seem to get anyone stuck. It's one of those things that it may not be allowed in the beginning or it gets stripped out, but you know, it's one of the major points of bill drafting that that legislators do consider heavily when creating these programs through legislation.
All right, coming up, more on the implementation of medical marijuana laws. Also, we'll hear what's going on around this in Maine and a little bit later, Connecticut. We'll also take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at medical marijuana laws here in New Hampshire and around the country, how sometimes the process from passing a law to actually having marijuana available to patients is slower than advocates would like. That's been the case here in the Granite State. We're looking at why, some of the controversies and complexities. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you on this topic at 1-800-892-6477. Joining us from Colorado is Carmen Hansen, Program Manager for the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan organization. She's been covering this issue as it's been rolling out around the country. Casey McDermott's here in studio, reporter for the Concord Monitor. She's been following New Hampshire's debate. And joining us now on the phone from Maine is Michael Shepard. He's staff writer for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And Michael, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So from what I understand, Michael, Maine's law passed pretty quickly after California in the late 90s. What are the basic parameters of the law as it stands right now in terms of, you know, who can have medical marijuana and who can provide medical marijuana?
So, yeah, Maine actually legalized medical marijuana for personal use in 1999 with, you know, more than 60% support, so it was pretty strong. But it really only impacted those who grew for themselves. So in 2009, we voted to set up a distribution system that was state-regulated and anchored around 8 dispensaries statewide that can serve people with one of, I believe it's 17 now, qualifying conditions and who get a doctor's recommendation. But we also allowed for separate caregivers, and these are just individuals, people who can grow marijuana for up to 5 patients at their homes, at outside facilities. And we have more than 1,700 of caregivers alone today. So our industry is pretty decentralized, I would say.
So, yeah, you've got this sort of wide-ranging system of individuals growing at home and 8 sort of official dispensaries, which is how New Hampshire is doing it. What are some of the issues that come up around that? Is there conflict between the two parties, for example, who are getting medical marijuana to patients?
Sure. I mean, dispensaries feel that, and they've said this, you know, many times, that they feel they're at sort of a competitive disadvantage with caregivers, because it's, you know, the state can't really regulate caregivers very much. This is a big state, as you know. These people are, you know, these facilities are all over the place, and they're particularly prevalent in rural areas. So dispensaries feel that, you know, it puts them at a disadvantage.
Although Maine is a big place, so, you know, if you have 8 dispensaries, that sounds like a lot for New Hampshire. We're only supposed to have 4, but Maine's large.
Right, right. And it's, you know, and caregivers were intended to fill those gaps.
So who are these caregivers? Are they, you know, licensed medical professionals in some way, shape, or form?
No, I mean, they are just people. You know, a lot of them were activists. A lot of them are, you know, they really cut across all of our, you know, all our demographics here. You know, there's really no way to easily answer that question because there's just so many of them and they all have such different stories.
Well, and one of the concerns here in New Hampshire that our governor has expressed is that if there were a home grow option, this Maine-style system of caregivers, that there'd be leakage of marijuana into the general public. Have you seen that in Maine?
You hear about it. I don't have any, you know, any convictions or anything like that. I haven't seen any convictions or anything like that here. But I'm sure it happens. It's sort of inevitable, right, when you have such a decentralized system and so many people, you know, with so many people potentially getting their hands on the product.
You know, hold on, Michael, because I want to ask Carmen Hansen. She's been looking at this nationally about this issue of the many caregivers. I think you said 1,700, Michael?
More than 1,700.
More than 1,700. Yeah. Carmen, how have other states viewed this idea of, you know, just regular folks growing this at home and signing up as caregivers?
Yes, most states that do allow for home grow have some sort of caregiver provision in there. Again, most of them are limited to, you know, just serving a handful of patients. And there is concern that because of the amount that that caregiver may grow on behalf of each of their patients, that there could be, you know, leakage or diversion into the black or gray market, depending on how you want to define that. But again, like Michael said, it's really hard to track because they're not tracked seed to sale like the dispensary growers are. So there's no reporting to the Marijuana Enforcement Division, such as the case in Colorado, of how much you're producing and how much you're selling to make sure you're within that boundary of not having anything leak out on you.
Seed to sale. Is that what you said, Carmen?
Seed to sale, yes.
Okay. Well, and another question for all of you, I think, but I'll start with you, Michael. What about local communities? What rights or responsibilities do they have in terms of whether they want to host a dispensary in their town? What's the situation in Maine, Michael?
There's really nothing that addresses that in Maine law, as far as I know. These places, you know, they operate in every, in, you know, not every town, I'm sure, but you know, they operate very quietly. I've been to some caregiver operations that, you know, the neighbors barely know, or the neighbors may not know that their, you know, that their neighbor in this very, very small town has, you know, is growing in their you know, modified garage or whatever. Very discreet.
What about the official dispensaries, Michael? Can towns say no to those if they don't want one downtown?
This debate has already sort of been had here because the locations have been were selected, you know, back after we passed the law in 2009. I thought there was I'm rusty on that because it hasn't hasn't been an issue.
Yeah, well, it's definitely an issue here in New Hampshire, Casey, as New Hampshire looks to set up 4 dispensaries.
Yes. So the state has been very clear that this will be that the dispensaries will need to get local approval. So that means going through zoning boards, planning boards, all of that fun stuff. And a number of the people who actually were applying for New Hampshire's medical marijuana program to act as operators for their dispensaries actually started having those conversations before the applications even opened. I had talked to a few people who said that they just tried to kind of lay the groundwork to make sure that these communities were potentially comfortable or open with them even before they formally filed the paperwork.
What sorts of communities are they looking at? I know you can't name names, but, you know, some people say, look, Manchester's an obvious. It's the biggest state. Other people say, look at Nashua, and then maybe you need one on the seacoast.
Right. So actually, the company that was selected to cover the region that includes Concord, Manchester, and I believe it stretches up to Franklin as well, that company has told me that they're looking at a handful of communities, and it's still very preliminary, but I think that they were saying Manchester, Merrimack, and Milford were the ones that they were looking at, particularly because of what kind of space was available there. They were looking for a site that would allow them to have both the dispensary and the cultivation site in close proximity. So they still have a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of conversations to finalize, but that will be happening in the next few months.
Well, and Carmen, you told us that in Colorado even, you know, a lot of Colorado counties say, no, we don't allow medical marijuana. Just looking at other states, Carmen, what's sort of the interplay between states saying, okay, we can do this, and towns or counties saying, no, thank you?
Sure. A lot of counties, when legalization happened in Colorado, both for medical and for adult use, had their own either local referendum or local election procedure to say, hey, you know, Boulder County or Weld County, do you want to allow this? Even though it's legal on the state side, we are allowed by statute to vote yay or nay on this. And so a lot of county boards and or localities put it on the ballot in their communities to give their own constituents another voice at it. Because there are many, like I said, you know, only 21 counties in Colorado do allow for sales of cannabis products. So it's definitely not everywhere. And some states or some counties and localities looked at the votes as they came in for their county and said, you know, our county did not approve this. And so they kind of took that as their reasoning to not allow it on a county or a locality level. That's the case like where I live, southeast of Denver, in a pretty large county. We do not allow the commercial grow or commercial sale of marijuana or cannabis products.
So most states, it sounds like, Carmen, aren't telling their communities, you have to do this.
The only exception to that is Illinois, and it just allows that the businesses have the right to operate, so you can't regulate them so they cannot operate. So you couldn't say something like, you can't operate within 5 miles of a school, knowing that those concentric circles would basically block out the entire town.
Yeah, that's going to be potentially tough, right, Casey, here in New Hampshire, the sort of drug-free school zone? Does that mean you can't have medical marijuana near a school?
I think that the distance is 1,000 feet, so that's shorter than 5 miles. So that would leave some more room here in New Hampshire than what it sounds like is available elsewhere. But that would be 1,000 feet of a drug-free zone or another, you know, school, which often are drug-free zones.
Okay. Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments about marijuana, medical marijuana laws here in New Hampshire or in other states. We're hearing about the experiences of other states, including Maine. A little bit later on, we'll look at Connecticut. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. What questions do you have about medical marijuana? Who can use it? Who can prescribe it? Who can decide to say, no, we don't want this in our community? 1-800-892-6477. And Michael, I also understand in Maine there's a debate over whether hospitals can use medical marijuana. What's the debate there?
Well, there's been a really interesting push for that this year. There was a very compelling public hearing on a bill that would do that, where parents of kids with chronic seizures and other issues argued for it. But, you know, it's a tough sell for hospitals, which are wary about it because they're afraid of losing Medicare reimbursements since marijuana is still illegal under federal law.
Yeah, people might be – give us a little more explanation there, Michael. People might be surprised to understand why hospitals are reticent, given that it is legal in a lot of states.
Right. Well, it's still being the first to wade into that issue. It's a difficult thing for hospitals to do in Maine particularly.
So they might get into trouble with the federal government. They might lose federal certification, federal funding, because this is still illegal under federal law.
Right. Right. I mean, that's what they're afraid of. I think it's regardless of whether it's likely or not that the federal government will come crack down on a hospital in Maine that's doing this, the concern is still there.
This is a big issue, Carmen, isn't it? I mean, this is really where the rubber hits the road with medical marijuana, the idea that states can do whatever they want, but then you have private entities like businesses, like hospitals and so forth saying, you know, we are really uncomfortable because of legal concerns.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. From what I've heard, many hospitals and other residential care facilities, such as nursing homes or senior centers, they have shown concern over the use of cannabis products on site because of that federal Schedule I status, seen as marijuana products having no medical value. But some facilities have created policies. It's definitely a small handful that I have heard of that allow for limited use of cannabis products on site, such as the use of some of the transdermal patches that are out, some of the tinctures or other non-smokable forms. But it is definitely a small number. But some have made an effort to accommodate patients in those, you know, severe categories.
Yeah, I definitely want to ask you a little bit later, Carmen, about the emergence of these non-smokable forms that apparently provide less of a high, although patients say the therapeutic benefits are still there. Let's go to our listeners. We're taking your questions and comments, lots of information about medical marijuana laws, how these are playing out in New Hampshire and around the country. And as we're hearing, there are a lot of logistical problems when it comes to putting these laws into place on the ground. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Susan's in Manchester. Hi, Susan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. There's an excellent article this month in the National Geographic on weed. And one of the things I think it really points out is the paucity of research that we've had here in the United States. We certainly know that there's definite medical benefits with some aspects of the marijuana plant that don't have the psychoactive ingredients in them, and yet they're very effective in pain management. And I'm concerned about dispensaries run by licensed lay people where the potency can vary, and I think some of your guests are alluding to that. I think of the poppy seed plant that provides the poppy plant that provides the poppy seeds we've been harvested and made into a pharmaceutical level for opioid pain medication that's prescribed by a licensed practitioner and obtained by a pharmacist. We didn't license poppy dispensaries. And I guess I want to know why we haven't done more research and really made this a medical quality and really utilized the good parts of the marijuana plant.
You know, Susan, this is a great question. And we did a whole show on this, Casey, a while back. The idea that it's hard for researchers to investigate what works, what doesn't, because of the federal prohibitions.
Yeah, it can be a real challenge. I actually was talking to a handful of people who are involved in some of the companies, either as medical advisors or on the boards for New Hampshire. And a few of them were saying that, you know, they're hopeful that by being involved in the operations in New Hampshire, that they might be able to find ways to actually study the effectiveness of various, chemical substances or better kind of get their, get their heads around where can we find the most effective uses for this and how can we make sure that we're doing this in a medically sound way.
Yeah, Carmen, have you looked at this, too? It's hard to figure out, you know, what's medically effective given prohibitions on the use of an illegal federal drug.
Exactly. The lack of federal funding, which drives a lot of medical research and different types of research, is not there yet. But the federal government is now allowing for some limited research for the benefits of cannabis-based products. So there is one company right now, GW Pharmaceuticals out of the United Kingdom, that has a product called Sativex. And it is a cannabis-based pharmaceutical product. So it is looking at one of those high cannabidiol products with the low THC. And it's inhaled, kind of like an asthma inhaler, to provide like an aerosol ingestion of the product. And they're now trying to expand clinical trials into the United States. But, again, because it is a cannabis-based product, our FDA would not currently approve that. So until something changes at the federal level, it will just stay in clinical trial use here in the United States.
Susan, thanks again for the call. Let's take Sheila in Wilton. Hi, Sheila. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a New Hampshire native, and I joined the Army after I graduated from UNH in 83, and they sent me to Alaska. I got out. I didn't want to go anywhere else. I used medical marijuana from 96 till 2009 when I came home to New Hampshire to care for my mother. When I came home, I provided Governor Lynch with all of the paperwork that I had on my process of medical marijuana in Alaska. It was prescribed because I had cervical cancer. He was not interested in even talking to me. So my question to you and the panel, which you're kind of touching on, is who is going to take the lead to let Obama's legacy be he took marijuana out of the erroneous Schedule I and put it in with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms where it belongs? Medical marijuana is useful, but recreational use is a danger to the people that are supporting medical marijuana use.
Sheila, I'm sorry to hear about your struggles, and I really appreciate you joining us with your story. And after a short break, Sheila, we'll definitely address once again this issue of, you know, the funny juxtaposition between state laws allowing this and federal laws not, and all the problems that it creates that we've been talking about. But I do need to say goodbye to Michael Shepard in Maine. Michael, thank you very much. We'll be checking back in with you again at some point as to how some of these changes are playing out there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Michael Shepard, staff writer for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And last question for you too, KC McDermott. I know you have a big story you have to cover today for us. What's next on this medical marijuana front here in the Granite State?
I think we're just going to continue to see the dispensaries work to set up their operations, start to get the substances, and hopefully, you know, open. They're saying ideally at the beginning of next year, I think, is the timeline that I've heard. And I think you're going to continue to see patients and other advocates push for a more speedy implementation of that timeline.
People like Sheila. So the next frontier for these is getting local approval, getting through that whole zoning process and so forth. All right, Casey, thank you. We know you have to go.
Thank you.
That's Casey McDermott, reporter for the Concord Monitor. She's been following New Hampshire's medical marijuana law. Coming up, we will talk to Ken Goslin. He's a business reporter at the Hartford Current in Connecticut. We'll hear what's happening there. And we'll continue to take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're discussing some of the complexities around medical marijuana laws in New Hampshire and nationwide. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Carmen, just before the break, we heard from Sheila, who had cervical cancer, who had some, you know, a lot of struggles around that, and was very frustrated by this disconnect that we keep talking about between federal policy concerning medical marijuana and state policies. And you talked about that already. But here's my question for you, Carmen. I do understand that a group of bipartisan group of senators got together recently and said, look, we need to change this. We need to help states out. I think it was Rand Paul and Cory Booker from New Jersey, and there's another senator.
Yes, there is definitely action at the federal level. A lot of senators and members of Congress from states that do have either medical programs or legal adult use programs that are trying to improve some of the situations that are hang-ups for people to implement these in the states, such as banking, which a lot of the rules that govern banking are federal laws. And so that's been a big hurdle in a lot of these states to see how the dispensaries and the growers can operate legally and have regular banking accounts and things like that. So that's been like one of the biggest hurdles that has affected the push at the federal level from the marijuana states.
I see. So in places like Maine, where you have, you know, more than 1,700 home growers, as Michael Shepard told us, those folks probably don't have to get bank loans, but the dispensaries do. Those are businesses. They've got to pay property taxes and electricity and so forth.
Yes. Most of the dispensaries in states need to be a cash-only basis. type of business, which can be frustrating. It's also harder to track the business activities of a cash-based business. So it is in the interest of both the states and the feds to implement some sort of rules around the banking of these marijuana and cannabis-based businesses so they are more easily tracked and can operate and pay their taxes just like any other business can.
Well, as we look at this issue of implementing medical marijuana law, some of the complexities that come up, we're going to turn now to Connecticut. And Ken Goslin is with us. He's with the Hartford Current. And Ken, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on today, Laura.
Well, when did Connecticut's law pass and how long did it take patients to actually get access to this drug?
Well, after some years of debate and discussion, the law finally passed in 2012. But, of course, there was a long lag time till the patients actually were able to access the medical marijuana, and that didn't come till September of last year, so about a year and a half. And, you know, over the course of that time, you know, the regulations were written. You know, so we're very tightly regulated here. They created a system of 4 growers that would supply 6 dispensaries around the state.
So 4 official growers providing 6 dispensaries. It's so interesting, Ken, because every state is so different. We heard about Maine that has more than 1,700 home growers and 8 dispensaries. New Hampshire, no homegrown, 4 dispensaries. So it's interesting to hear about all the differences. So it took a year and a half then in between passage and actual implementation.
Yes, it did. And, you know, in that time, you know, there was they're seeking out. There was a lot of interest in the dispensaries and among the growers who want, you know, parties who wanted to come in. You know, there were several dozen people who wanted to run dispensaries, concerns, and then there were also, you know, about 20 who wanted to be growers. So there was a fair amount of interest.
Well, and Ken, you've written that not as many patients have signed up for this as people predicted. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, it was very slow in the beginning because when people started to be able to purchase back in September, there was a part of the regulation said that you could not sell what is called a whole bud or flower. It had to be ground, so it would be very homogenized. There was a big concern in the regulations that everything be very standard. What people purchasing got, they would get the exact dosage, that it would be very tightly controlled. And what they found very quickly is that the potency or the usefulness of grinding up that flower was not very, you know, it just didn't work very well. So pretty quickly, the state altered its regulation to now allow dime-sized buds to be sold, and that has kind of helped a little bit. Also, the amount or the breadth of products now has expanded in incredibly into edibles, into tinctures, into, you know, just a wide variety of things. So that is helping, but it's still in its very early stages.
So people who might not want to, quote unquote, smoke a joint might be more comfortable with a tincture, an oil, an inhaler or something like that.
Exactly. And that is what the dispensaries are telling me. I just wrote last week, Connecticut is looking to now expand the number of dispensaries, mostly to areas that are underserved. Most of the dispensaries are concentrated really in central and northern Connecticut, and Fairfield County and New Haven County, it's a little bit sparser. So the expansion, adding more dispensaries, doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, this demand has like shot up, but it's just they're trying to get it geographically to more people, they say.
You've also written, Ken, I think that doctors in Connecticut are a little bit hesitant to register to participate. What's their concern?
Well, their concern is that the lack of research, that they are, you know, still waiting to see more. And, of course, research is very scant on this. And so they that is really their big concern. I think early on there was the concern, the federal laws, you know, and just the handling of marijuana. But I think that since that issue is now appears to be being resolved, that the concern now is the research and what are the long-term effects here.
Yeah, that's a concern that one of our callers raised earlier. And just stay with us for a minute, Ken and Carmen Hansen. I want to go back to our listeners. And Deb's joining us from Conway. Hi, Deb. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling to voice a concern with doctors over-prescribing medical marijuana, issuing medical marijuana cards. And I've seen it in California, where I have a family that have gotten the cards, and I just feel like it's like an antibiotic use. that doctors overprescribe, that they won't be as streamlined with it.
And not just doctors, Deb. I think in some states, Carmen, you know, lots of people can prescribe. And as we've said, that's not quite the right word, right? Give us a little more there, Carmen. It's tricky.
Sure. It's usually called a referral or a recommendation because of the Federal One status of marijuana or cannabis-based products. You cannot call it an official FDA-approved or DEA-approved prescription. So it is called a referral or a recommendation. For an example, if you're concerned about overprescribing, even though someone has a prescription or a recommendation or a referral for marijuana or cannabis products, they have limits, purchase limits, and or how much you may have in your possession at any given time. Most of the state laws have that. And it generally ranges from anywhere from 2 ounces to up to 10 or more, but generally a very small amount of roughly, you know, 2 to 6 ounces is pretty average for the purchases or quantity that you can have at any given time.
Have you looked, Carmen, at California? Because I understand the concern that Deb's hearing. I have heard other people express the same concern about California. They see pictures of, you know, a dispensary in every corner, you know, signs out front that seem to say, you know, got a hangnail, come on in. You know, have you looked at California and the sort of openness there?
Well, I mean, the California is one of the outliers, so to speak, when it comes to the type of programs that are implemented. Again, California has one of those higher possession limits. They can have 8 ounces, or and if they're growing their own, they can have 6 mature plants or 12 immature plants. And they can also fill out an application to have more than that for whatever their need might be. But again, that has to be overseen by a physician and approved by a physician.
A physician. Okay, so there's some sort of trained medical professional involved, even though you look at the pictures and it looks like, you know, anything goes.
There is the intent of the state laws that are out there. They require that physician-patient relationship. So that could be the primary care doctor that you see all the time, or it could be someone that you just went to see for maybe a 15 or 30-minute evaluation to have your application filled out. So not every doctor is willing to do that. And, you know, in Colorado in particular, there are only about 800 physicians that have written a prescription or a referral or a recommendation for medical use for an application. And that still has to be reviewed by, in Colorado, it's the case of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. So someone else is still looking at it. So just because it comes in signed, someone else still reviews it to make sure it meets all the conditions, that someone has a qualifying condition and a qualifying symptom, and that the paperwork is filled out properly and the doctor has signed and testified that they or can attest to they have seen the patient and reviewed their medical records accurately.
Okay. Well, Deb, thank you for the call. And, you know, it does raise a question. I think I'll throw this to you, Ken. When New Hampshire was discussing its law, you know, a lot of people said we don't want to be like California. And Carmen said California is kind of an outlier when it comes to these laws. What about the experience of California, Colorado, other states? How did those inform the debate in Connecticut, Ken?
Well, I think there wasn't very much a concern about what you were just talking about it being so, you know, street corner-ish and what have you. That really kind of focused when the regulations were written here very, very tightly regulated. Like if you walk into a dispensary here, you don't see the marijuana. It's not visible. It's not in the canisters, you know, the photos that you often see of it being displayed. It's not that way at all. So it is not like in your face at all, really.
Okay. Well, again, Deb, thank you. And let's go to John. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the exchange, John. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just would like to have your participants discuss the disparity between the regulation of marijuana and alcohol and the clear abuse of alcohol that results in thousands and thousands of deaths every year, both by ingestion, automobile accidents, acts of violence, et cetera, and whether or not there are financial interests that are delaying the implementation of medical marijuana in New Hampshire. The other thing I just thought of the other day was sugar, which is apparently considered a cause of national diabetes.
A lot of concern about the sugar epidemic. Actually, John, I'm going to let you go just in the interest of time, and I do apologize, but he's making a point that a lot of people have made in this state, Carmen, and that is, look, don't pick on marijuana. Alcohol's a lot worse. I don't know if you've heard that discussion elsewhere.
I have heard that discussion. Many of the advocates that are out there, and again, the National Conference of State Legislatures does not advocate for or against any particular state law. However, by tracking this issue for the last 2, 7, 8 years, I think I've lost count, that the pro, you know, medical marijuana folks and or legalization argument is that they do use that comparison of let's look at the social causes of the use of alcohol and the social causes or social ramifications of the use of marijuana. And so that is something that they have used as an argument, and some other folks have used a similar argument as well. But, again, that's something that the advocates tend to say, let's regulate something like an alcohol product for adult use.
Well, John, thank you very much for the call. And a couple more questions about the particulars in Connecticut for you, Ken. And then broadly for you, Carmen, Ken, I have an email here from Curtis who says, would insurance cover it? Now, has this been a discussion in Connecticut? I mean, Hartford, right? That's the insurance capital of the country.
Has been said many times, yes. No, it does not right now. And that is a huge concern because of the cost. It's higher than what you would pay on the street. And it is not covered by insurance. So that is a topic that has been discussed but has not been resolved.
Yeah, and I think your paper profiled a woman whose symptoms had been just really dramatically reduced. She felt like she sort of had her life back thanks to medical marijuana. Yeah, go ahead, but it was expensive.
Exactly. She told me she was paying between $14 and $20 a gram for her medical marijuana. And, you know, you figure the 28 grams an ounce, so you can just do the math very quickly. That adds up. And they said, she and her husband said that was a very difficult thing because their income was limited, wasn't covered by insurance. Sure, all the drugs she used to take, you know, which had these very terrible side effects, were covered by insurance, but she didn't want that anymore. So here she has something that is really kind of is helping her quality of life, and it's very expensive.
Okay, and here's an email from Matt responding to our earlier caller, Deb, who had a concern about California and the sort of freewheeling nature of medical marijuana there. Matt says there is no comparison between New Hampshire law and California. For example, he says there is no requirement for a doctor-patient relationship in California. That makes a big difference in who qualifies and how. Matt, thank you for the email. One last question for you, Ken. We talked earlier with our other guests about local communities and how they feel about having dispensaries located within their borders. What does Connecticut's law say about whether cities and towns can say yes or no?
Well, the cities and towns are given a lot of authority in that regard. And right now, even as of last week, one town in western Connecticut, Harwinton, is debating this whole issue, even considering this law has been in effect for so long, as to whether they want to allow a dispensary or a grower within their borders. So it is still very much a topic of conversation. Early on in the licensing process, Bridgeport was hoping to have a dispensary, you know, kind of centrally located near highways and such, and the Planning and Zoning Commission rejected that, and that dispensary had to find another location.
Wow.
So there still is very much a debate about this.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ken Goslin, business reporter for the Hartford Courant. And one last question for you, Carmen, as well. What states will you be watching the most on this issue? There's a lot to cover.
There definitely is, even though there are 23 states and two territories that currently do have laws on the books. At least 20 states had legislation in 2015. Most of those measures have died, but 8 still remain alive for the remainder of this session. And again, Pennsylvania right now seems to have a bill that's getting a lot of hearings and a lot of movement, but you never know what can happen from one week to, or even one day or one hour to the next with this issue. So I'm sure it'll keep me busy for another year at least. And states are still tweaking their programs. So just because a state has a program up and running, there are constant amendments and bills proposed to, you know, ideally improve on these if they've come across road bumps that they can somehow tweak and improve through additional legislative process.
All right. Well, Carmen, thank you for helping us out today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Carmen Hansen, Program Manager for the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan organization. She covers medical marijuana laws for NCSL. She's based in Denver, Colorado. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Noah Bunnell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.